This morning, our speaker is Bob Kimbrough. Bob earned a BFA, which I believe is a Bachelor of Fine Arts. Yes. In photographic media from the University of Utah and a JD from the Nashville School of Law. He worked as a divorce attorney for 4 years until he stopped to preserve sanity. For the past 18 years, Bob has worked as a technical writer and editor for firms such as Deloitte & Touche, ADS, the United States Air Force, and the United States Courts Administrative Office. Since 2008, he has worked as a consulting technical writer for Becton Dickinson, a medical technology company. He says he is very fortunate to be allowed to work from home, with the occasional jaunt out into the world to mix things up. An avid motorcyclist, Bob is a veteran of the U.S. Navy, a certified scuba diver, a licensed private pilot, an avowed anti-authoritarian, and an avid eclectic reader, the chair of your membership committee. Bob will speak on the topic, the fifth principle in a time of crisis. Attention must be paid. Let's welcome Bob.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here. I can remember the exact date of my first memory, October 4th, 1957. I was three, almost four. My dad carried me outside that evening, and my entire family looked up to see Sputnik speeding across the night sky. I don't remember much else about that night, but I do know I was profoundly impressed. I've been looking at the night sky ever since. Do you need to take that? 1957 was also the International Geophysical Year. IGY was an international scientific project that lasted from July 1st, 57 to December 31st, 58. It marked the end of a long period during the Cold War when scientific interchange between East and West had been seriously interrupted. This also marked the beginning of the space race between the U.S. and the Soviets. For a child of four, this was impressive stuff. The first human in space, Yuri Gagarin, and the first American, Alan Shepard, happened when I was in the first grade. The last person to walk on the moon, Eugene Cernan, did so in 1972, the year I graduated high school. Those 12 years in between were an exciting time, Vietnam notwithstanding, sorry, Joe. The Civil Rights Act, Medicare, Medicaid, and great music and art. It was a heady time to be a teenager, if you'll pardon the pun. For my generation, our fathers fought the Second World War, came home, hung up their uniforms, and proceeded to build the American middle class. This was largely made possible by the Serviceman's Readjustment Act of 1944, more popularly known as the GI Bill. By the end of the war, U.S. industry was retooling for civilian consumption, but officials knew there was very shortly going to be some 8 million soldiers, sailors, and airmen discharged back into civilian life. With nowhere near enough jobs for these people, it was decided to send them to college. So, sorry, I thought I missed something there. When your drunk uncle yells that government can do nothing right, tell him that for every $1 the government spent on the GI Bill, $8 was returned back into the economy. It's one of the most successful government social programs in history. In the post-war years, things were booming. College in California was free, and in most other states, tuition was essentially an honorarium. I know this will make some of you younger folks mad, but the 18 hours I took at UT Knoxville in 1972 cost $144. Our interstate highway system and cheap fuel made it possible for more citizens to broaden their horizons by traveling. Carl Sagan said of this period, it was a fantastic time to be alive, and he was right. 90% of humankind's knowledge has been obtained in the past 100 years. But something happened in 1980 called supply-side economics, or Reaganomics, if you will, trickle-down, and other terms that we're not going to say in polite company. I'd like to quote from The Newsroom. Some of you have seen The Newsroom in HBO. what I think is the best 3 minutes in television since the Apollo 11 moon landing. Jeff Daniels' character is asked why America is the greatest country on Earth. His reply, "We're not the greatest country in the world, Professor. That's my answer." You know why people don't like liberals? Because they lose. If they're so effing smart, how come they lose all the time? And with a straight face, you're going to tell these students that America is so star-spangled awesome that we're the only ones in the world who have freedom? Canada has freedom. Japan has freedom. The UK, France, Italy, Germany, Spain, Australia, Belgium has freedom. So out of 220 sovereign states on the planet, 180 of them have freedom. There's absolutely no evidence to support the statement that we're the greatest country on Earth. We're 7th in literacy, 27th in math, 22nd in science, 49th in life expectancy, 178th in infant mortality, 3rd in medium household income, number 4 in labor force, and number 4 in exports. We lead the world in only 3 categories: number of incarcerated citizens per capita, number of people who believe angels are real, and defense spending, where we spend more than the next 26 countries combined, 25 of whom are our allies. When you ask what makes us the greatest country in the world, I don't know what the F you're talking about. Yosemite? But we sure used to be great. We stood up for what was right. We fought for moral reasons. We passed and struck down laws for moral reasons. We went to war against poverty, not poor people. We sacrificed and cared about our neighbors. We put our money where our mouths were, and we never beat our chest. We built great things. Excuse me. That's stubborn. We built great things, made ungodly technological advances, explored the universe, cured diseases. We cultivated the world's greatest artists and the world's greatest economy. We reached for the stars, acted like men. We aspired to intelligence. We didn't belittle it. We didn't identify ourselves by who we voted for in the last election, and we didn't scare so easy. We were able to do all these things and be all these things because we were informed by great men, men who were revered. The first step to solving any problem is recognizing there is one. America is not the greatest country in the world anymore. Enough? The fifth principle, of course, addresses the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. And I think this is a very timely topic in this silliest of silly seasons. And what is the crisis? Specifically, we're faced for the first time, at least in my lifetime, with a candidate for president of the United States who is an abject fascist. The Cambridge Online Dictionary defines fascism as a political system based on very powerful leader, state control of social and economic life, and extreme pride in country and race, with no expression of political disagreement allowed. This is new ground in modern American politics, but it didn't happen overnight. Way back in the 1920s, Upton Sinclair wrote that when fascism comes to America, it will be wrapped in a flag and carrying a cross. The potential for this has been in the American DNA since our founding. The deliberations of the Constitutional Convention of 1787 were held in strict secrecy. Consequently, anxious citizens gathered outside Independence Hall when the proceedings ended in order to learn what had been produced behind closed doors. The answer was provided immediately. A Miss Powell of Philadelphia asked Benjamin Franklin, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" With no hesitation whatsoever, Franklin responded, "A republic if you can keep it." Never has that warning been more timely. What we have now is a de facto plutocracy, a rule by the rich. It is the Republicans, certainly, who bear primary responsibility for this. They are the party that launched us on our modern era of tax cutting and wage suppressing. They are the ones who made a religion of the free market and who fought so ferociously to open our politics to the influence of money at every level. These days, Republicans are rolling in deep fantasies of persecution and capitalist authenticity. Not only will they not reverse course, but they often seem lost to reason itself. What afflicts them would take an expert in mass psychology to cure. But it is time we understood that our economic situation represents a failure of the Democratic Party as well. Protecting middle-class society was the Democrats' assigned historical task, and there was a time when they would have taken the job with relish. Shared prosperity was once the party's highest aim. Defending the middle class was kind of a sacred mission for them, as they never used to tire of reminding us. And Democrats are still the ones who pledged to raise the minimum wage and tax rate of the rich. But their big mistake was to turn their backs on labor, which they did back in the 80s. As an aside, I've noticed that all of this has taken place, come to fruition, if you will, as the World War II generation dies off. There aren't a whole lot of those guys around anymore. I can't, of course, speak for them, but I think I know how they, being children of the Great Depression, would feel about successful people pulling the ladder up after them and denying to others their chance at the pie. This is an age of democratic failure, but what makes it so bittersweet is that it's also an age of democratic successes. A liberal spring, as the New York Times put it in 2015. Gay marriage is legal, the Confederate flag is coming down all across the Deep South, and America is today led by a black president. And consider the way that Fortune 500 companies boycotted, pulled out of, and isolated states that have passed laws attacking gay rights in the name of sincerely held religious beliefs. And yet so much remains. We're the only industrialized first world country that views healthcare delivery as just another free market commodity. It is said that taxes in those countries that have provided healthcare to their citizens are too high. In reality, our taxes may be nominally lower, but in effect, we pay a much higher tax for fees, copays, premiums, pharmaceuticals, and we have worse outcomes than the so-called socialized medicine countries. Our public universities are being drained of funding by Republican state legislatures. As I mentioned earlier, there was a time when you could relatively easily work your way through college. I had a high school friend who managed to graduate from Vanderbilt while earning his tuition as a grocery clerk. I don't think you could do that now. But these days, college is out of the question for more and more of our young people, and those who do attend are saddled with the ball and chain of high loan paybacks and no option of discharging the debt. This is a hidden, insidious tax. Would you willingly contract for a debt that more often than not pays little or no dividend, that you cannot discharge in bankruptcy, and will indeed be collected from your Social Security should you die and still owe a balance? This is the only consumer debt of which I'm aware that allows retirement income to be seized. It is outrageous, insidious, and needs to stop. When adult children have to sacrifice and mortgage their homes to care for their ailing parents, something that enlightened countries do for free or for nearly so, there is a hidden, insidious tax. When working parents are forced to sacrifice a significant portion of their income on daycare fees, there is a hidden, insidious tax. Particularly egregious is the fact that daycare workers are among the most underpaid in the country. When corporations like Sprawlmart refuse to provide living wages and hours to its employees, there is a hidden, insidious tax. In this case, it's estimated that each store in the country costs the American taxpayer $400,000 in AFDC and CHIP benefits for its employees. These enlightened countries do pay more taxes, but when you factor in these hidden taxes, we are paying a lot more and getting a lot less. And do I even need to mention the price of certain life-saving drugs whose cost have been raised by executive action over 10,000%? Justice Louis Brandeis once wrote that he didn't mind paying taxes because he liked civilization. But these kind of actions to me are just uncivilized. And we are currently paying taxes so that state governments can hire and retain private prison companies. And the contracts with these companies contain minimal occupation clauses, which in effect mean that even if the prison population drops below a given number, the state still has to pay as if the facility was fully occupied. There is profit in keeping people locked up. This is immoral and unethical. There is also profit in not maintaining the public water supply, to wit, Flint, Michigan, and numerous other cities with outdated, indeed dangerous infrastructure. Charter schools are proving to be nothing but profit centers for private corporations. Today, the American class divide is starker than at any time in my memory, and yet Congress doesn't seem to know it. Today, the House of Representatives is dedicated obsessively to the concerns of the rich, to cutting their taxes, to chastising their foes, and to holding the tissue box as they cry about the mean names that people call them. As a son of a soldier, I learned about World War II and its causes and results, particularly Hitler and the Nazis. I remember teachers at almost every level saying, in effect, this could not happen here. I wish I could find those teachers, some of whom had fought in that war, and tell them that it can and indeed is happening here. And that brings us to the final term in this paper, attention must be paid, which you'll recognize from Arthur Miller's The Death of a Salesman. The pertinent quote is from Linda. I don't say he's a great man. Willie Loman never made a lot of money. His name was never in the paper. He's not the finest character that ever lived, but he's a human being, and a terrible thing is happening to him. So attention must be paid. He's not to be allowed to fall into his grave like an old dog. Attention, attention must be finally paid to such a person. The United States is currently a lot like the object of this quote. We may not be great anymore, and we're probably not the finest race of beings that ever lived. But it is a noble effort to prevent us from falling into our graves like old dogs. A lot of us here today have seen the things this country can do when we set our minds to it. We can be great again, and I know it's in the American character. We can be great again, but not in the manner that a certain presidential candidate means, but great like the quote from the newsroom. We can take care of our citizens, provide free education, and provide a living wage to all full-time workers. If we can pay $3 trillion for two unnecessary wars, we can certainly have universal health care, at least single payer. So attention must be paid. As the Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson wrote, it is not the function of our government to keep the citizen from falling into error. It is the function of the citizen to keep the government from falling into error. Attention must be paid to the first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. We have a candidate for president who thinks Mexicans are thugs and racists, would block an entire religion, Islam, from entering the country, and further would move to summarily deport an estimated 12 million so-called illegals from the U.S. Attention must be paid to the second principle, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. We have a candidate for president who wants to bring back waterboarding and beyond. No civilized nation has ever turned to torture as a viable means of obtaining information. It has been proven time and again to be counterproductive, eliciting no information of value. Attention must be paid. The third principle, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregation. American society, as I've said, is more polarized than I've ever seen it. One thinks of the first stanza of William Butler Yeats's poem, The Second Coming, written in the aftermath of the First World War. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Attention must be paid, the fourth principle, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. This is something the owners of this country do not want, a truly educated population. They want reliable, faithful, obedient workers who know just enough to do the paperwork, but not enough to question anything. Further, our public education system is under constant strain caused by a number of factors, prime among them what I call militant ignorance, the consumer movement in education, and the introduction of mysticism as a putative alternative to the teaching of not only Darwinian evolution, but climate science, and for some reason, Einstein's theories of general and special relativity. As Carl Sagan once observed, we have arranged things so that almost no one understands science and technology. That is a prescription for disaster. We might get away with it for a while, but sooner or later, this combustible mixture of ignorance and power is going to blow up in our faces. We'll hear more from Dr. Sagan a little bit later. Attention must be paid. The sixth principle is the goal of world community with peace, justice, and liberty for all. We must stop the global war on terror. It is not and has never been a problem subject to military remedies. As horrible as terrorist attacks and their death tolls are, it is largely a law enforcement intelligence problem and should be approached as such. We continue to operate drones around the world. A drone is essentially a flying weapons platform. Drones are responsible for the creation of more terrorists than probably both Gulf Wars put together. They've killed scores of innocent people, and some of their operators are now having to seek treatment for PTSD because they realize it's not a video game, but those are human lives that are being destroyed with the push of a button from an air-conditioned compartment outside Las Vegas. Attention must be paid. The seventh principle is respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Unbridled capitalism knows no limits as it continues to devour the Earth's resources at an alarming rate. Left to its own devices, there will eventually be nothing left. And this goes hand in hand with global climate change. Deniers will say that humans can't possibly affect the weather. In his epic novel Dune, Frank Herbert foresaw this type of denial 40 years ago. The thing that the ecologically illiterate don't realize about an ecosystem is that it's a system. A system. A system maintains a certain fluid stability that can be destroyed by a misstep in just one niche. A system has order, a flowing from point to point. If something dams that flow, order collapses. The untrained might miss that collapse until it was too late. That's why the highest function of ecology is the understanding of consequences. Part of our current failure to understand the consequences arises from a campaign of deliberate misinformation. Today, there are only six media conglomerates left in the United States. There are some of us here today who remember the bad old days of only three networks and black and white instead of color. Way back then, the networks placed Chinese walls around their news organizations and further expected these news organizations to lose money. Also, there were a lot more newspapers than one finds today. The upshot of this system was that the citizen had many choices and voices when it came to pricking power, to use Izzy Stone's term. What you are being fed today as news is merely corporate-approved dicta. And in the law, dicta is a polite term for bullshit. Ask yourself, when was the last time you saw a reporter of any stripe ask pointed, insightful questions of a politician? And when was the last time you heard a politician give a clear, cogent, and convincing answer? Attention must be paid. Most of our government representatives are essentially wholly owned subsidiaries of whatever business interest gives them the most money or promises the biggest post-congressional rewards, i.e. jobs. They are appointing industry executives to head what are supposed to be controlling agencies. This is literally putting the fox in charge of the hen house. It's easy to forget that the United States was founded during a rare period of human enlightenment. The ideas contained in the Bill of Rights were considered radical at the time, but the dumbing down of America is most evident in the slow decay of substantive content in the media. 10-second sound bites, lowest common denominator programming, credulous presentations on pseudoscience and superstition, often on outlets with ironic names like the Learning Channel or the History Channel. But especially egregious is a kind of celebration of ignorance. And so we face a stark choice this November. I can't tell you who to vote for, but the future of the United States hangs, as it has never hung in my lifetime, in the balance. I realize many of us aren't thrilled with the mainstream candidate for the Democratic nomination. There is another candidate that most of us, I think, would be a far better choice. But this is the nature of political reality. Sometimes you just have to hold your nose and pull the lever because the alternative is too horrible to contemplate. Remember that it was the German people who elected Adolf Hitler, and that didn't work out so well for them. We can change the current situation. It's going to take all of us working together tirelessly and relentlessly. But the first and foremost method is to vote. I can't overemphasize this. Research has proven that George Bush was elected in 2004 because of the evangelical turnout. We need to mobilize to be heard. As Arlo Guthrie sang in Alice's Restaurant, if you want to stop war and stuff, you gotta sing loud. Intelligence is our ally. Reason is our ally. But the forces of ignorance are all around us. Whenever our ethnic or national prejudices are aroused, in times of scarcity, during challenges to national self-esteem or nerve, when we agonize about our diminished cosmic place and purpose, or when fanaticism is building up around us, then habits of thought familiar from ages past reach for the controls. Reason and logic are the flames that guide us. Attention must be paid because when neglected, as Carl Sagan warned us, in the demon-haunted world, the candle flame gutters, the little pool of light trembles, darkness gathers, the demons begin to stir. Thank you.